Which judge was first found in a wine press by the angel of the Lord? Do you guys remember that?
Gideon.
That's right. Yeah, they find him there in the wine press where he's hiding, he's threshing the wheat, and that's where the angel first appears to him. Which judge had a special vow to the Lord from his birth?
Samson,
that's right. A Nazarite vow from birth, and we'll talk about that later in the segment. What other book takes place during the period of the Judges? Do you remember? Book of Ruth, yeah. It says it took place during the time of the Judges, that's right. Which of these, multiple choice now, which of these was not one of the oppressors of the nation of Israel during the Book of Judges?
The Assyrians,
that's correct. We do read about the Midianites and the Moabites and the Ammonites, but the Assyrians, that's going to be sometime later. All right, fill in the blank on these phrases that are found really like in the last five chapters of the book. But does anyone remember these phrases, how to fill in these blanks? What's the first one? Yeah, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did
what was right in his own eyes.
That's right. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Again, we read that really in the last section. Those two phrases appear multiple times, and we'll talk more about that as we go through. Last one here, which judge was related to one of the two spies who gave a good report of the land when Israel first tried to enter? Remember, two spies of the 12 gave a good report. Do you remember which judge is related to one of them?
Othniel,
yeah. He's the, I think, nephew of Caleb.
And son-in-law.
That's right. That's right. Nephew and son-in-law as he becomes. That's right. All right. Again, well, beginning of each class, we'll try to run through similar factual questions just to help us help our memory. All right. So as you guys hopefully know, we are studying the book of Judges this segment. This is going to be, of course, kind of an introduction, an overview class today. We'll talk about all your, standard introductory facts to the book that we usually go over in these type of classes. And really, it's dangerous putting things at the end like this, but at the end, we want to really focus on thinking about themes, thinking about, what are some good reasons to even study this book? Hopefully you're able to give that some thought even before this class started. We'll talk about those more at the end. But I'm excited about this study. I think I probably speak for David, too, who's going to be my co-teacher. Excited about it. This is a book that, I've heard these accounts, many times throughout my life. But each time you study this book, it's like you get something else from it, even after you've, gone through this book many times. So looking forward to our study. And this, of course, is a book of Old Testament history. It's not just a history book just meant to cover history, but it is one that covers, a significant time period in Old Testament history. And any time that we, are doing that, I think it helps to kind of set ourselves in where we are in the timeline. Some of you may have been in the Joshua class that just ended, and if so, then you're in a great place. But if not, maybe it's helpful if we kind of set ourselves on where we are in the story through the Old Testament. Of course, this is one common division of the time periods. I know there are others out there, but this is one of them. And, of course, we're going to be in the time of the Judges. But if you remember back at the time of, like, the patriarchs, where God made the promise to Abraham, the threefold promise, one of those being there would be a land for his descendants to dwell in. Of course, we're going to see the fruition, or in Joshua, you really see the fruition of that promise. There would be a great nation, and then through his seed, all nations would be blessed. And, if you remember, that nation really kind of grew when they were in Egyptian bondage. And God, delivered them from Egypt with his mighty power, delivered them. They at Mount Sinai, you know, they made the covenant with the Lord that he would be their God and they would be his people. They initially tried to enter the land, but, you know, like we mentioned earlier, you know, the spies went out to spy out the land. And 10 of them, you know, what was their impression of the Canaanites? You know, they said, these people are just too big. You know, these cities are fortified. I mean, their initial impression of the land and the people was, maybe you can call it intimidation. Maybe you can call it they were just impressed with them. You know, that was really the first impression they had was one of, you know, how are we going to do this? I mean, look at these people. Look at these cities. And so because of their lack of faith, their unfaithfulness, they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. And then Joshua, of course, led them in that initial invasion and conquest of the nation. I want to spend a little time. I think it's worth just setting the context for what happens in Judges and thinking about, like, what the plan was for the conquest. Like, this is how it was supposed to go. This is, if everything went perfectly, again, you know, we'll look at a passage that I think that shows God knew that it wasn't going to, but this is how it was supposed to go. And maybe the most important thing to point out there, that it was always going to be God that was going to lead them to victory. Moses prepares them in Deuteronomy chapter 9, 1 through 3. He says, "Hear, O Israel, you're to cross over the Jordan today to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you, cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim whom you know and of whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak? Know therefore today that he who goes over before you as a consuming fire is the Lord your God. He will destroy them and subdue them before you. So you shall drive them out, make them perish quickly as the Lord had promised you." You know, the Israelites were never going to outnumber the Canaanite armies, or that it was very rare that they would come anywhere close to matching their numbers. Okay, but that wasn't going to matter, because God was going to be the one that was going to lead them to victory. He says again something similar in Deuteronomy 20. I won't read this entire passage here, but he starts, "When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you." So, you know, they were going to be outnumbered. You know, there was going to be superior technology. You know, the chariots was kind of like the technology of the day, and the military advancement was how many, you know, iron chariots you had. Well, you know, their enemies were going to have those things, and they were not, yet that wasn't going to matter. Okay, so he prepares them for that before they go into the land, that it was going to be God who would lead them to victory. But do you remember what, so when they would go in and they would fight against these people, do you remember what their objective was, I guess? What their objective was when they would encounter these people? What were they supposed to do?
Literally.
Wipe them out.
Yeah. Yeah, devote them to destruction, right? You know, God was very, very clear about that. This is Deuteronomy 7, the first five verses, where he says, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession and clears away many nations before you," I won't read all those nations, but "and you defeat them," he says, "then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods." So, you know, he tells them again that they're supposed to devote them to complete destruction, which, you know, that's can be a source of some criticism from skeptics that, you know, how can God, you know, order his people to devote, you know, entire cities and peoples to destruction? But I think, you know, I think there's a couple reasons why he told them to do that. But what's the concern, like, in this passage on the screen? You know, why did God want them to completely destroy the Canaanites? What was the concern?
Purity.
Purity, yeah, really. It was a concern about their influence, right? And the influence that the Canaanites could have on them. You know, that, you see all the sentences about, you know, not having any covenants, not not intermarrying with them, you know, destroying their idols. You know, God knew that this was going to be a temptation for them. You know, if they did not carry out, you know, the devoting them to destruction, that they were going to be a source of temptation. He says that in Deuteronomy 12 there in the passage on the scene, on the screen, that, you know, take care that you're not ensnared by them. So they were to destroy the people and destroy the altars and the gods, out of concern for that influence. I think he also, not just concerned for the influence, but also a judgment for their wickedness. He says in chapter 9 that don't say in your heart, it's because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess the land, whereas it's because of the wickedness of these nations the Lord's driving them out before you. So we're not really talking about an innocent nations here. You know, this was judgment for their wickedness. So I think, again, one, judgment for their wickedness, but also it was out of concern for their spiritual well-being. They're told to destroy them. But also, we need to point out that the conquering of the land was always going to be gradual. I think if you read maybe like a surface level reading of Joshua, maybe you get the impression that they went in and they just took all of the land out. You know, there's just no one left. And, you know, Moses did say, God did say through Moses in Deuteronomy that the conquering would be, I think he said, little by little is the way he puts it there. And he actually gives a practical reason in that passage in Deuteronomy 7. He talks about the beast would come and take over if, you know, if the land was just dormant. So it was going to be, after Joshua's initial push, that it was always going to be gradual. You know, Joshua would conquer many of the main cities and areas. So as many of you guys probably just studied in that Joshua class, you know, Joshua comes in kind of in the middle of the land, has like a northern campaign and a southern campaign, and really takes out the backbone of the Canaanite people, though the best way to put that. But, you know, in Joshua 13, God tells them there's still, you know, more of the land that needs to be conquered. But before the rest of the land was conquered, you know, Joshua divided up the inheritance among all the tribes. And then it was really the tribes that were responsible for, occupying their allotted territory. You know, so the inheritance was divided up, and it was up to them to really kind of occupy their land and fight against those peoples in that area. There was some alliances that we see, but it was really, again, more up to them to occupy their allotted lands. So continuing on, I think it's important to point out that, you know, success and peace in the land was always going to be conditional. You know, it was always going to be, if they obeyed, they would be blessed. And if they did not obey, there would be all those curses we see in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy. You know, materially, they would be cursed. There would be pestilence and sickness and oppression, and they would be defeated. So it was always going to be conditional. And we, you know, we see God, you know, in the book of Judges, of course, being faithful to what he said there in that chapter when they fail to obey. And then when they do obey, the blessings that come with it. So I think it's important to remind ourselves that it was always going to be conditional, and they were told that up front. So for those of you who just studied Joshua or have studied it before, how did they do with that? How did they do in the book of Joshua with what God told them to do, just generally?
I think Susan and I were the only ones who were in the Joshua class.
Okay. All right.
I won't put Susan on the spot. I mean,
you answer.
Yeah. One of the themes of Joshua is to be careful to obey the law, to do everything that God has said. And one of the things that repeats over and over in the book, makes it one of the most joyful books in the Old Testament, is that they did everything God said. Their obedience was remarkable in the book.
That's right. Yeah. You know, Joshua, I mean, they took the whole land. Again, I don't think that's literal. I think that's, you know, took large portions of the land according to all that God had spoken. So their task of devoting the people to destruction, you know, they did that for the most part. And then also we see really like the very end of the book, there's that great passage there about the people saying, you know, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods, for it is the Lord our God who brought us and our fathers up from Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who did those great signs in our sight and preserved us in all the way that we went and among all the peoples through whom we passed. And the Lord drove out before us all the peoples, the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore, we also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. And that's the one where Joshua then comes back and says, no, you can't do that. God is, he's a holy God. You won't obey him. And the people come back and say, yes, we will. And so the book really ends like on this spiritual high, you know, like everything is great, which is one pretty significant contrast from the book of Judges, where everything kind of ends on a pretty, you know, spiritual low. But again, at the end of Joshua, you know, they're doing what God told them to do, and they are committed to serving him. So, you know, hopefully that wasn't excessive in terms of review, but I think it always good to kind of set our minds, especially, you know, Deuteronomy is such a rich book of all the things that Moses told the people. So I wanted to highlight some of those because they're going to, I think we'll refer back to them when we talk about some things in the book of Judges, some ways where they came up short and what they were told to do. But let's talk about, you know, some of the, I guess, facts about the book of Judges. Does anybody know who wrote the book of Judges? That would be pretty remarkable if you did, and please share with us who it is and how you know, because we're not really sure. There's reasonable speculation that it was Samuel. That's certainly a very good hypothesis, given the time parameters of when this was likely written, which we'll talk about in a minute. But we don't really know who wrote the book. Samuel's a good candidate, but can't say with certainty. Let's think about when the book was written. There are some phrases in this book that do indicate maybe some time parameters, some before and after parameters for when it was written. Like here in chapter 18, there's a statement made in that story in chapter 18 where it says, so they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. When you listen to that phrasing, it sounds a lot like this was written after the ark was at Shiloh, after it had been moved, right? Referring to a time before when it was at Shiloh. So if you remember the story in 1 Samuel 4 where the Philistines, they capture the ark and it's removed from Shiloh. You know, just based on that textual evidence, maybe we can put that as a parameter for it was written after that event. But then we also get this text in the first chapter of the book where it says, so the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. To this day, is that talking about 2021? Obviously not. It's talking about from the author's perspective. If you remember, you know, David took Jerusalem from the Jebusites in 2 Samuel chapter 5. So based on that textual evidence, it would sound like it was written before David took Jerusalem back from them. So think about it, you know, you got a before and after, or after this event, before this event, you get kind of at least a range of when it was written. You know, again, you know, starts maybe with the time of like Eli going all the way to like right when like David was about to become king, somewhere in there. Again, that's why Samuel is a plausible guess. You know, he was a prophet of God during that time period, but again, we can't say with certainty. All right, so the book of Judges itself, so it's called the book of Judges. How would you guys define these judges in this book? You know, are we talking like someone who sits and decides court cases, you know, who's guilty and who's not guilty, or what are we talking about when we say the judges in this book?
Leader.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Anybody else have any descriptions?
I think of them as God-appointed rescuers.
Yeah.
At least from a leadership standpoint to help rescue them.
Right. Yeah, the book actually gives us a pretty good definition. There in chapter 2, chapter two is going to serve as like somewhat of like an inspired overview of the book. We'll see that on Thursday when we get into that text, but he gives a pretty good definition of at least what is being considered a judge in this book. In chapter 2, verse 16, it says, "Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them." So, you know, we do get a few things, you know, from that. One is that, okay, these are God-appointed men and women, right? So, you know, we're going to read about one character in this book, Abimelech. I think in chapter 9, he gets put in the list of judges a lot of times, but he's really not because, you know, he just made himself king. And so, you know, these judges were God appointed. God raised them up to carry out this task. Well, what was their task? Well, according to this verse, you know, to save the people, you know, to deliver the people. You know, they saved them out of the hand of those their enemies, the hands of those who plundered them. So that's really maybe a better way to think about it: a savior or deliverer, leader was said. That's a good one too. That's probably the best way to think about the judges in this book.
Jake, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, this verse here, 2:16, the Lord raised up judges. Do you think it's possible that the Lord could raise up judges who didn't know that God had raised them up, meaning that they're not like appointed leaders? I'm thinking of Samson, for instance, mm-hmm. who was clearly appointed by God. I mean, his parents received, you know, miraculous prediction of his birth and his life and his work, and yet he never seems to have done anything that was, you know, leadership quality actions. Yeah. He's almost more of a terrorist than anything else, and clearly God raised him up, but I wonder if Samson really thought of himself as acting in God's interests. Jephthah might be another example of that. I don't know. I mean, we know that God raised up the Babylonians and the Assyrians to do his right. work, and they certainly didn't think of themselves as his servants.
Right.
I don't know. I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, it does seem like they're just being used as really, you know, tools for God's, you know, deliverance of his people. Because you're right, it doesn't seem like Samson or Jephthah or others really know. Like we have the example of Gideon, which we'll read about, I think, in chapter 6, you know, where the angel comes to him and kind of like declares what his mission is going to be. But I don't think we can assume that all of the judges had a similar episode where the angel came to them and convinced them of what they were. So I would tend to lean towards not all of them did know that they were acting as in this special role, but God worked through them. Now, we do read about the Spirit of the Lord being on at least several of them. So could the Spirit of the Lord be on them, but they not be completely aware of what they're carrying out on God's path? That's an interesting question.
Like Saul prophesying, for instance.
Yeah.
Same language is used to describe that.
Right. Yeah, that's a good parallel too. So I would tend to lean towards saying no, they were not all aware of their functioning in this role that we see in 2:16, but yet someone else may have more evidence to the contrary there.
Samson doesn't really fit the case anyway. In 2:16, 2:16 is kind of talking about the cycle, right?
Which
you're going to get to, I'm sure, at some point. But in Samson's case, he was raised up by the Lord to begin to deliver them from the Philistines. The job wasn't done during his lifetime, so there really wasn't enough time for the whole cycle to complete itself through him. But
he's an interesting case. Maybe all the way around, he we'll talk about that in a minute, because there seems to be a trend in the judges in their character, how they seem to get kind of worse and worse as you go through. So Samson's an interesting case, because you're right, he doesn't fully deliver them, kind of just starts that the Philistines will kind of oppress them even after that. So we'll talk more about that. But you know, to support maybe the idea of judges being these deliverers or saviors, we have military activity recorded for 6 of the 12. Those happen to be what we call the major judges. Major just being there's more said about them. 2 others have a passing reference. to military activity. Like a Fetola, I think it says he saved Israel. And Shamgar, oh, we may remember him. He has his, you know, his trusty ox goad, where he kills like 600 Philistines. So, again, kind of a passing reference to some military activity. And the other four, I think it just says they judged Israel. I say that, you know, there is one instance at least where, referring to Deborah, where it says people came to her for judgment. So she was in a little bit more of a role as a legal advisor. I think some have made the leap that, okay, that meant that all of the judges were serving in that capacity. I don't know if I would make that leap necessarily. It may have been that just Deborah happened to be serving in that additional role as a legal judge that we normally think of as a judge. So here's again, just breaking out major and minor. Again, that's really just kind of like we do with the prophets. You know, the longer the book the prophet wrote, we call them major prophets. The shorter is minor, and it's the same here. Just there's more said about those in the major category and less the minor. Again, Abimelech is he's put in here a lot. I know the song I learned as a kid, it has Abimelech in there, and he's not really a judge, and you know, kind of just made himself king, and so I don't really want to give him credit for that. So he's not in the list here. And then there's also two other men who the scriptures say judged Israel that are not in the book of Judges. Eli is mentioned in 1 Samuel. He judged Israel 40 years. Samuel also judged Israel all the days of his life. So we're not going to necessarily talk about those two individuals in this class, but just mentioning them. All right, so let's talk about the timeline of the book. I'm trying to hurry here to get to the themes, but the timeline of the book is a little bit confusing as a source of a lot of, I don't know, debate maybe, I'm not sure, a lot of research and maybe just confusion. But because if you read through the book of Judges, you see a pattern of, you know, this many years of oppression, the judge stayed in this many years of rest, then another judge came, this many years of oppression, this many years of rest, and it kind of sounds like they're just happening back to back to back to back to back. And if you took that approach or thought that, you could add up all the years of oppression and rest, and you would get to about 410 years total from Othniel to the end of Samson. The only problem with that is that you have a verse like this one in 1 Kings 6, where it gives a timeline here from when Israel left Egypt to the fourth year of Solomon's reign, and says 480 years. So if that's 480 years and all the times of oppression or from Othniel to Samson is 410, you only have about 70 years left to fit a lot of things in, like wandering in the wilderness, the reigns of David and Saul, and time of Sam or the time of Samuel and Eli, and the time of Joshua, and there's a lot to fit in there, and you really just can't do it. So, you know, so what does that mean? How can we reconcile that? Well, I think the book of Judges makes it pretty clear that these judges were operating at the same time, at least some of them. We have overlapping judges. Like, for example, in chapter 10, it's going to say that God raised up the Ammonites and the Philistines. And, you know, Jephthah is going to be the judge to deliver from the Ammonites, and Samson is going to start the deliverance from the Philistines. And so while we read about them, you know, in consecutive stories, they're in different parts of the land, and it seems like one good explanation is that they were operating at the same time. And then 13:1 talks about the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. And so, you know, Samson and, you know, we read about like Eli and Samuel in 1 Samuel, the Philistines are also, they're still there. So there may have been some overlap in the time of Samson and Samuel and Eli. It's hard to know how much, but again, you know, there very well could have been some overlap. There's a mention in Jephthah's speech in chapter 11 about being occupying an area for 300 years. I don't know if Jephthah was speaking in exact terms there necessarily, but it gives kind of an idea that it may have been less than the 410 that I had in the previous chart. So this is kind of a crude equation here, that if you start with 480 that's mentioned in 1 Kings 6:1, you take out the 4 years that Solomon had reigned so far, you take out 40 years for David, you take out 40 years for Saul. One commentator estimated there was at least 5 years between the end of Samson and Samuel, and then 16 years they estimated for the time of Joshua. Again, those are the estimates that the commentators came up with. You take out 40 for the wandering in the wilderness, and you're left with about 335. Again, that's not exact, but the main point I think to take from this is that it's less than if you just added them all up, and that you have judges serving at the same time, I think, at different parts of the book. So, again, sorry, we can't be more exact than that, but, again, I think the takeaway needs to be that these aren't happening just back to back to back to back. I'm just going to mention – oh, go ahead. Sorry.
The people of the Congo are bracing for a possible.
Oh. I guess background noise. Jake, one other thing, though, and you may be mentioning it somewhere. The fact that the judges appear to be a little more regional than the kings were later on. They seem to be associated with their tribes or a group of tribes, and it's not the whole land and all of the 12 tribes of Israel that are necessarily being oppressed or delivered at any one given time sort of fits in well with this idea that they may have overlapped in time as well.
That's a good point. Yeah, it very well easily could have been, yeah, like a regional conflict up here and another one down here, or in Jephthah's case on the east side of the Jordan while Samson's on the west side. So you're right, that kind of supports that likelihood. So I'm just going to mention there's another view that puts the Exodus much later. I'm not even really able to articulate all the reasons why that view is taken. I think it has to do with the 480 and 1 Kings 6:1 being a little bit symbolic than literal. There's also an archaeological argument or a lack of archaeological evidence argument made, and I'm not going to go much into that, but even if that view was taken, the point is still the same, that it's going to be less than that 400 years if we just stacked them all up. So, all right. Were you guys able to in the material that we passed out before, ask if you could at least come up with an outline or a description of each of the three sections of the book. What did you guys come up with for the first section, the first couple chapters and the first six verses of the third?
Introduction.
No. My summary is rewriting the end of Joshua. So it's like kind of systematic. The judges' writer seems to go through and systematically say everything you thought was true at the end of Joshua isn't actually true. Right. They didn't conquer all the land. They weren't very faithful. They had all these problems, you know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Did anybody else have a description?
So Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord.
That's right. They certainly did. Yeah, the chapter one is going to be like it's going to describe their efforts to conquer the land, and then beginning of chapter two is basically like, you didn't do very well. You failed, right? You did evil in the sight of the Lord. I'm going to call it failure and its causes, you know, just because in chapter one is going to talk about their failure to take the land, and I think there's a lot of emphasis on why that happened, and we'll kind of on Thursday try to make that the focal point of our class is like, okay, why did this happen? So we can avoid that, avoid it ourselves, certainly. I'm going to move through the others just for the sake of time. The middle section is the largest. That's where you have really the cycles of the judges' deliverance. It's where you have all the stories that we're most familiar with there in that section. And then the last section is a pretty dark, disturbing, at least the second story in those five chapters. And it's really two stories at the end that I think are just meant to show just the cultural decline of the nation, religiously, morally. And so you have those at the end. Those two stories at the end, by the way, are not necessarily at the end chronologically. I think there's strong evidence that indicates that they happen like even early on. But I think they're put there at the end for a reason, just to show like, look, to leave a lasting impression, like, look, this is how bad it got. Right, so they're put at the end, I think, for a good reason. If you like short descriptions that start with the same letter, you can use defeat, disobedience and deliverance, and then disgrace for the three sections. Or if you just want to go with just two, you can go causes and consequences. It's kind of a loose way of dividing up the book. All right, so let's think about themes. What did you guys see in terms of themes? And this doesn't even have to be yet like these are applications or these are lessons, but just as you read through the book, what do you see over and over or multiple times, or what trends do you see as you look through the book? With Tom, I'm going to have to go fast and give a brief. Yeah, go ahead.
I think you have to think at least in terms of a theme, that repeated cycle that we'll see. That,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know what all you would pull out of it. You know, it could be just every generation has to be vigilant and things like that, but
yeah,
definitely the cycle.
Yeah, that's probably what we're most familiar with this book, right? It's just that cycle. Here is the actual cycle where they would sin. You know, they would serve the Baals. They would forsake God. God would send an enemy. They'd be subjected to servitude. You know, they would have to pay tribute, or they would plunder their crops or oppress them in some way. And then they would cry out to God. We'll call that supplication. And then God would send that deliverer to save them. And then they would have years of rest, like while the judge was alive. And then they would start over again. So just for the sake of memory, we'll just, you know, we'll try to remember it this way: sin, servitude, supplication, salvation. So four S's and then one R, rest. And we're going to see that, I think, six times through the book. You see that over and over again. And there's a lot of lessons and just to take from breaking up that cycle in different pieces, but just the cycle itself is a big theme. I'm going to, again, for sake of time, run through these. You see the spiritual deterioration of the Israelites. I think that's certainly a trend you see. I think there's several like trends through the book, and they're all pretty much like negative. They're all downward. Like, you know, they're just the morality of the nation really seems to go down. The character of the judges themselves, like there seems to be more and more character flaws as you go through. Like ending with Samson. Like Samson, there's a lot of flaws, not a lot of good, really. You know, Gideon is somewhere in the middle. You see some good, some bad. And you just see, like, it's like the cycle just starts going. It's like a cycle, but it starts going down and down and down, even as it cycles around. Like from the Israelites and their behavior, as well as, like, the character of the judge. You know, maybe not be a perfect trend, but it seems to follow kind of that path. The national unity seems to kind of deteriorate. So, you know, throughout the book, there's a lot of infighting, like, the Ephraimites in particular, they're always like stirring up some trouble and they're fighting. And then at the end, like they want to wipe out a whole tribe, and just their unity as a nation seems to just get worse and worse, as you go through the book. And I think, one more thing on this. I think the author puts a particular emphasis on the causes of that, and we'll try to take note of that. I think he wants you to see this is why this happened. We'll talk about that on Thursday a lot from the first two chapters, but let's look for that as we go through, like, okay, things are bad, but why are they that way? You know, because I think that's really where we learn and can use this as a cautionary tale. The presence and faithfulness of God, certainly. You know, we see God in that cycle where he hears their cry and sends a deliverer. We see the angel of the Lord appears at least twice to specific judges. He appears in chapter 2 to the whole nation. God sends a prophet in chapter 6. So, you know, obviously God's presence is throughout the book. The character of the judges is certainly, we see some good, we see some bad as we go through the different characters. So I'm going to try to, like, flip this over into the, and think about, okay, well, why study the book? I think, for one, to learn from the failures of the nation. Like I just said, you know, I think he's trying to point out, like, look, this is how bad things got. But this is why. Because, you know, because they did what was right in their own eyes. Because there was a generation that didn't know the Lord. You know, because they compromised on what God said. So, especially, you know, Thursday, this is going to be a big focus of the class, is why did things go so bad in chapter one? You know, because I think we can, not because we want to save our nation and we can return the United States to a godly nation, but because these same things can happen in our families and can happen in our church and can happen to us individually. So we need to learn from those failures. Also to remember God's faithfulness to his people. I think it's Psalm 83, that a psalm of Asaph, where they're reflecting on God's faithfulness during this time of the judges. So obviously the original audience of this, that was an impression that this book made on them, was like, wow, remember God when he delivered us from the Canaanites and from the Midianites? And that's what they look back on. So as we read this, you know, we need to be impressed with God's faithfulness to his people. You know, also looking at scripture, what did they take from this time period? Well, the Hebrews writer, he took, you know, several of the judges there in Hebrews 11 and I think tells us that we need to learn from their character. There's a lot of good things said about some of the judges in Hebrews 11, their faith. You know, it wasn't because they were perfect people, but because of their faith, you know, there's things that we can learn from them. So we want to do, you know, really some character studies as we go through the book and look at some of the things we can learn not to do and some of the character traits that we can emulate. And I'm going to end with, lastly, just, it's a good idea, I think, anytime you study the Old Testament, to try to see Jesus, try to see Christ in that book, whether it's prophecy or foreshadowing. And hopefully we can already see maybe what some of that foreshadowing is of Jesus in this book. I mean, just think about what we said about who these judges are as saviors and deliverers and what they did for the people. And we can hopefully be impressed with Jesus as our ultimate deliverer, I guess, for lack of a better way to say that. So, you know, as we go through, let's be impressed with that. We can appreciate, you know, looking at them, we can appreciate who we were before God and the condition we were in, and that we had a savior and deliverer come and save us. So, I hate going through the last two slides that fast, but again, time management's not a strength of mine. So this is kind of this should be in your packet. The way we'll go through the course, we'll look at the next two chapters on Thursday. Again, we'll kind of, look at in chapter one what happened in their efforts to take the land, and then spend maybe the second half of the class thinking about why things went so wrong and take some lessons from that. So any questions or thoughts at the end here?
Jake, you mentioned your theme of foreshadowing of Christ. Uh-huh. I think maybe one of the greatest foreshadowing of Christ is this recurring statement that there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we see the failure of, I don't know, non-divine leaders, right? Yeah. They're God appointed, but they're just people. And they could never be kings. They could never be what Christ became. I think the shortcomings of their leaders, reflecting the shortcomings of the people generally, highlight the need for a king. And that obviously has clear parallels in our spiritual condition.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's something I think we need to think about as we go through the class. Like that phrase, again, I think it appears four times in the last five chapters. There's no king in Israel. There was no king in Israel. I think the book actually ends with that phrase. I think it'd be good for us to think as we go, like, what does that mean? I think a lot of it is what Mason just said, but, you know, did having an earthly king, did that solve all their problems? Well, I mean, we know from our reading the Old Testament that that wasn't the case. So what is he talking about there as he keeps saying, you know, there was no king in Israel. So we'll talk about that more as we go through. All right, well, I guess we'll wrap it up there to give you guys time to adjust for our 6 o'clock. But I appreciate everyone's participation.
Thank you, Jake.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.